Hello, everyone. Thank you for choosing one of the best sessions. Thank you for being so wise in choosing the red session that you should sit in. So today, our session is about another generative AI model, but not for the text or audios. It's about our very familiar tabular data. So the two speakers today, the first one is Hugh Miller, probably does not need an introduction anymore, who is a principal at Taylor Fry, has lots of experience, expertise in spending welfare, employment, housing, disability, and health, and was 2021 Actuary of the Year. And our second speaker graduated from the best university in Australia, UNSW, who is Justin. And Justin is a manager at Taylor Fry and has over 4 years experience advising government clients, regulators, and self-insurers. So please join me in welcoming first Hugh to the stage.
Thanks so much, Faye. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thanks for attending. So this is a session about AI models, but most AI sessions are about how to use some of the big models coming out of the big tech firms. This is quite a different beast. It's about sort of building neural network models that answer specific sorts of problems that come up in our work all the time. Probably quite general purpose in many ways as well. So Justin is here to present as well, which is fantastic. We have a third contributor, Callum, who's not presenting today, but he did a lot of work on this as well. So props to him. So let's get into it. In terms of content, I'm just going to give a bit of an introduction, a bit of motivation for the session. I'll talk about the types of models that we've been building and experimenting with, and then I'll walk through a baby example. And once we've done that, Justin can take you through a more complex real data example and sort of discuss the implications and conclusions off the back of that. So to introduce then, so neural network models are popular. That is a massive understatement. So neural network models and AI models, I sort of use the term interchangeably, perhaps not quite right, but they have changed the world in the past few years. It's well documented. However, they've made less of an impact on structured data sets. So I'm thinking of the types of predictive models that insurers often build to understand claims costs or other things like that. And I think there's probably scope. And so the problem we're looking at today is the situation where we've got more than one outcome, so at least two outcomes that we're interested in, and where the outcomes are dependent. So if you look at the first picture, you might sort of say how many cars are in that picture, but you might also ask how many red cars are in the picture. And so you've got two outcomes. They're obviously connected because one can't be bigger than the other one. And that's the type of problem we're quite interested in. And the advantage of formulating a problem that way is that if you can build a submodel that actually sort of builds up an understanding and structure for one problem, it's probably useful for the other as well. So in this case, if you had a vision recognition system that was good at counting cars, it can probably be repurposed to answer both those questions at the same time. The other comment is modern AI models actually seem quite good in terms of their prospective ability to answer these sorts of questions. So the second chart on the right there, that's an AI-generated image, and that is exactly what we're talking about, because each pixel is a response, effectively, and so it is generating a lot of different pixels, so that's more than two, more than one. And they're obviously dependent, like they actually have to fit together to make a coherent picture. So that hopefully gives you an idea of the type of thing we're trying to do, but in a structured data setup. In the paper, and there is a paper, so if you are interested, sort of look for detail there. We do discuss about sort of other work in the literature that's most akin to what we've done today. It's probably around the variable imputation, where people take structured data sets with observations missing and try and build up a structure of that data set and try and fill the gaps. And we've kind of turned a predictive task into a gap-filling exercise, which is quite neat, I think. So is this a useful thing to study? At least from our end, we think it is. And so the example I'm going to give of why it's a useful thing is microsimulation models. And these are models that tend to predict things and generate and project things at a very granular level. So there are a whole bunch of actuarial microsimulation models floating about. actuarial in the sense that they're built by actuaries. I don't really know what the correct definition should be. But these tend to project people through their lifetimes. And so there's an example there from the New Zealand model on the right, where we're predicting people through the benefit system and the housing system and the justice system, as well as projecting their incomes. And they'll bounce around different systems. They'll have different levels of income over time. And the task is to project that. And if you can project that well, understanding people's current risks, you can actually do quite powerful things in terms of finding cohorts that might benefit from programs or initiatives, or actually being able to track progress over time as you roll out programs. So these actuarial models are very tricky and quite expensive. So there are sort of versions for the Australian welfare system. New Zealand has a big adults model. There's a big model in New Zealand for kids. There's a veterans model that sort of runs on this principle as well. Some of the states have sort of big interconnected models. And what tends to sort of be common is that they're very time-consuming and expensive to build. And the reason why is because there's a whole bunch of outcomes. So in that example there, if you're trying to predict welfare status, there's a whole different sort of series of benefits people might be on, and you have to sort of model how they move between them. At the same time, you might need to project income, and those things are obviously very dependent. And so effectively, if you've got 100 outcomes, you need to build at least 100 different models to try and correctly sort of move people through the system and the projection. And because of that, they can cost millions of dollars to build, which can be quite cost prohibitive, I guess, for time, these types of things. This type of microsimulation is also not restricted to actuarial work. So there's a lot of sort of policy work that involves microsimulation. ANU's got a policy sim center that does a lot of good work. And a lot of the agent-based modeling you see nowadays for digital twins or even pandemic modeling take a lot of these ideas as well. So this is quite a powerful thing, and it obviously meets our criteria today, where we're predicting more than one thing. So we're predicting whatever's happening next time period, and we might have 100 different things to predict, and they are tightly sort of dependent on each other. So that's the motivation. Hopefully that gives a bit of a flavour. I'm not going to have many formulas, but I'll do one just to pretend that we're doing science. So what we're trying to estimate is a set of variables, x1 through to xp, at time t plus 1. So basically what's happening next period, next year. And what we know now is what's happening at time t. So it's the same variables plus a bunch of static variables or deterministic variables. So for static variables, I'm thinking things like age and gender. You know exactly how they evolve over time. Then for the x's, we've got things like income or welfare status, which are varying over time, and you want to predict using what you know now. And so the traditional way to do that in a microsim is you start with X1 and say, let's predict that one first. What's going to happen to that given everything we know? And then conditional on X1 at time T plus 1, you estimate X2 and then you build your models up that way. And so that's obviously time consuming. You're building separate models. And the other thing to point out here is we are actually quite interested in distributions, so generating distributions, not just estimating the means. And that adds a layer of complexity. So when you're talking about income, you might know that on average income stays the same, but for individuals, income might bounce up and down. And actually understanding that's quite important for modeling trajectories over time. So that's our setup. And now we're going to attack it with a couple of neural network type models. So GANs and VAEs. So GANs stands for Generative Adversarial Networks. VAEs, Variational Autoencoders. Both of these are reasonably popular, well-known in the neural network sort of AI literature. But we do have to repurpose them because a sort of a vanilla GAN, vanilla VAE don't quite do what we need it to. So this chart here is a vanilla GAN. And the idea is you've actually got two networks. And so a network is a interconnection of sort of layers of nodes. If you've seen a neural network before, you'll sort of know what I'm talking about. And in the pure GAN, the intent is to start with some noise and you train a network so it turns that noise into sort of legitimate looking fake or synthetic data. And so that's that first stage there. You also at the same time train a discriminator network, and its job is you feed it both fake data and real data and you ask it to distinguish between the two. And then you get the result of that, and that actually feeds back into the network. And feeds back in both for both the networks. for the discriminator network, you reward it if it's correctly telling the difference between the two. You say, good job, keep pushing parameters in that direction. For the generator network, you reward it if it tricks the discriminator. So if it tricks, you sort of feed it back and say, good job. You must be sort of generating some useful stuff. So in some ways, it's a surprise that training two models at the same time works. It was invented at a pub about 10 years ago, but seems to be quite effective and is used in a range of sort of situations. So to convert it to what we need to do, we need to add a lot more boxes, as you can see. So what we're going to do is we've now got our time t variables, our static or deterministic variables, as well as our time t plus one variables in play. And so what we're going to feed into the generator network is latent noise, just as we had before, but also all our sort of known variables, so time t static. We're going to feed that through, and we're going to try and generate some time t plus one variables. We're then going to stack that t plus one time variables on top of the original data again, and that's going to be our fake or synthetic data. And we're then going to also feed our real data set into the discriminator network, and that real data set's also that extended one that has the time t plus one and the static. But apart from that, the rest of it runs the same. So can the discriminator model distinguish between fake time t plus one and real time t plus one? If yes, give it a pattern back. If no, give the generator a pack on the back and sort of roll from there. The second type of model is a variational autoencoder. If you've seen compression algorithms before, that gives you a slight flavor of what's going on here. The idea is you're building two networks, an encoder and a decoder, and the vanilla VAE that we've got here will take some real data. It'll compress that to a smaller latent space, and then a decoder network will try and take that latent space and expand it back into the original data. And then there's a loss function that drives the learning there again. And the loss function is a combination of, does your generated data match your real data input, like squared error or something, as well as how regular your latent space is. So it rewards a latent space. In this case, the latent space is actually a distribution, like a multi-normal distribution, rather than pure numbers. But it sort of rewards that being sort of well-ordered and tight. And so those two things actually balance each other. There is a parameter in VAEs that you can use to balance that, but it's actually trying to get a compressed version of the data that still allows you to recover it. And that's actually a good way to represent. And then once you do that, you can actually generate data points in the latent space and just use the decoder network to project or sort of generate going forward. Once again, we have to modify this to suit our problem, but the intuition is pretty much the same as the GAN, where we're basically making sure we feed the encoder and decoder networks that original data, so the time t and the static variables at the right points, so that the decoder network, rather than just working with latent space, you're effectively conditioning that generation on what you know, so the time t and the static variables. And once you regenerate, you can obviously then sort of reattach the time t and static variables, and then you've done your synthetic generation. So the learning and formulae are all the same. It's all really about sort of rearranging the networks so we're feeding that information that we know to the networks at the right time. So the question is then, does it work? And I guess it would be a slightly disappointing presentation if it didn't. But we're going to start with a simulated example. So for this one, we're going to sort of ignore time t. So we're just going to sort of express it as we've got six variables. Four of them we know, so those four are kind of the time t ones, and two we don't know, so they're kind of the time t plus ones. And so for those two variables, x5 and x6, we want to simultaneously generate them with our networks. So we just basically generate things. The formulas there aren't important, but we generated them so that they have sort of strong nonlinear relationships between them, including a sine curve. And so that actually then creates something of a challenge for our models to try and reproduce. And so we do our training, and then we do our generations off the back of the training and see how well that generated value matches what we want it to. So the good news is it does work. So univariate statistics are useful, but don't really give you a good sense of sort of everything. And I think that the way I'd characterize this is sort of good, but not perfect. So most of the means and standard deviations are working, and it allows us to generate on different scales, and there's lots of good things going on. Perhaps it's slightly more useful to talk about distributions. And so we've just got a few sort of two-way scatter plots on the chart. The ones that get me most excited, all scatter plots get me excited, but the top right one, you can see the relationship between our generated X5 and our known X2. The red is the synthetic data, and the blue underneath it is the real data. So you want to see those things line up. And it does really well. And in this particular case, you can see the heteroscedasticity. So on the left-hand side, there's a lot wider variation, and it seems to be capturing that really well. The other one that's quite nice, you may not be able to see if you're on this side. On the bottom left, the relationship between X5 and X3, there's a boundary effect that has been generated. So for low values of X3, it is pushing the generated values of X5 up, and it seems to be doing that really nicely. The last one I wanted to talk to, so I've got both the GAN and the VAE sort of up there, is the relationship between X5 and X6. And so these are ones we've generated simultaneously, and they have that sort of slight sine wave relationship between the two. And it seems to be doing good, but not perfect. So on the left-hand side is the GAN, and you can see that that shape's been captured. There are some sort of blue dots up, sort of upper right that doesn't seem to be captured as well, which suggests that some of that outlier distribution isn't quite captured. But in the main, it really is sort of capturing that shape quite nicely. And this is effectively doing it for free. We haven't sort of told it anything about those relationships. And on the right-hand side, the VAE seems to have done it a slightly more smoothly, so there's not quite the same elbow, but again, sort of capturing most of the shape. So that's exciting. And so the real question then is, can you make this work on real data and all the complexities that live in that, which is not my problem.
Thanks, Hugh. So now that we've seen how this works on a sort of simulated, you know, simplified data set, the natural next question is, how does this work on real data? And so the data set that we use is called Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia, or HILDA for short. It's a longitudinal data set, which is really important for micro-simulations. Those who are familiar with HILDA will know that it's a panel study. It essentially surveys the same respondent households every year, which allows us to track and measure the evolution of their outcomes over time. It's been running since 2001. So to give you a feel for the, sort of the size of the data set we're working with, it's about 100,000 records spanning 2017 through to 2023. And it's about 74 columns. So we're essentially trying to predict all of these 74 columns in one go, many of which are dependent on each other. That's the kind of problem we're dealing with here. And HILDA's really good because there's an extensive cleaning and imputation process that goes on behind the scenes, which ensures, you know, good data quality to work with. And it's a very rich data set, which includes outcomes typical of many micro-simulation models, things like your employment outcomes, education, demographics and healthcare, as well as their welfare utilization. So next, we'll go through, I guess, just some of the challenges with extending this to real data. And you know, there are quite a few challenges here. The most basic one being looking at how do we deal with binary and categorical variables. And so the naive way that you would do this is to essentially, you know, sample from a categorical distribution, like we're sort of, you know, rolling a dice. You get a single outcome on the top face of the dice. The issue with that is it's not differentiable. Those of you who are familiar with neural networks will know that they undergo a process of backpropagation to optimize the model, and that requires differentiability. That doesn't quite work. What we use instead is what's called the Gumbel softmax trick, which you can think of as a sort of fuzzy dice roll instead. So instead we get essentially a series of probabilities representing the outcomes of that dice roll. And that this Gumbel softmax trick basically allows us to sample approximately from a categorical distribution in a differentiable way. And there is like a slight difference in the way that we implement this across the GAN and the VAE models. Essentially, we modify the loss function for the VAE. The reconstruction error in the VAE is actually constructed as a weighted sum of the mean squared error, which is what we use for continuous variables, and cross entropy for categorical variables. And we balance the two of those using a hyperparameter, which we tune in the background. So that's dealing with categorical and binary variables, but the continuous ones are also a lot more challenging as well. Continuous variables in practice will operate on many different scales, and often you'll have a lot of outliers in the process as well. So taking this sort of dummy income chart I put together, you might have a lot of them that might range, say, $70,000 to $80,000, for example, but you could have a whole bunch who are sitting all the way out in the millions, for example. This sort of, you know, these outliers make it difficult to fit the model. You have problems with model convergence, for example, as these outliers might have undue leverage on the fit. And so what we do then is we standardize all of the continuous variables by essentially subtracting the mean, dividing the standard deviation. That's not the only problem here, in that many of these variables, again, income's a good example, are actually not continuous, but rather a mixed distribution. For example, having a large point mass at zero and a continuous curve there afterwards. The point at zero being those who are not working, for example, in the context of income. And we address this essentially by including an additional binary variable. So for example, a flag that represents when that person's income is zero, and we model them in conjunction with a check that goes on during the forward pass to ensure that they are compatible. And so it would be a bit sort of pointless if we're looking at microsimulations for a single time step. The point of many of these models is to project over a long period of time. And the way you would usually do these is to chain the models together iteratively. For example, using the time t data and simulating time t plus one using this, and then taking that t plus one data back and feeding in again, and you get time t plus two data, so on and so forth. And we do show how this works later on in the results. There's also an alternative way, in that you could actually jump all the way, for example, from time t straight to t plus three in one step, provided that you have enough data. And we do look at this to understand the accuracy and the stability, to see, you know, is the chained approach actually stable, or do you get a sort of model drift over time when comparing it to the single step approach instead? And a couple of other considerations. So interdependence between individuals is quite common in a lot of data sets. For example, members of the same household will have dependence between each other. We consider this sort of out of scope of our research for today. But you know, you can deal with this through a simple extension. For example, modeling household income first, and then training a second model that is conditional on this, and then applying this household income to other members of the same household. A relatively simple extension. And in terms of looking at missing variables, we didn't have any missing variables in our dataset after a sort of cleaning process, but you could address this by treating it like a mixed distribution instead, where the point mass is just, you know, is that variable missing? So a relatively simple extension as well. Now, looking at the model architecture. So what we show here is the architecture for the GAN. But the VAE's architecture is largely quite similar. We show on the top the generator model. So the input is 76 variables. So there are the 74 variables I talked about earlier, as well as two deterministic variables, which essentially just are age and gender here. And we pass that through a series of dense layers with the number of nodes sort of getting smaller and smaller over time to force it to learn the behaviors in the dataset and the interaction in the dataset. And we also pass it through a number of rectified linear unit layers, or ReLU for short. Those who are familiar with these know that it helps to learn nonlinear behaviors in the dataset. And that eventually gives you an output of 74 nodes representing the 74 variables in the dataset that are being generated here. There's also a discriminator model. So this has 76 input nodes. And we pass that through a number of dense layers, and we finally end up with a single output after passing through the sigmoid, and that output is basically, you know, what's the probability that this data set is real or fake. Okay, so before we kick into the results, we'll just take a look at how do we evaluate these models now. And our sort of primary metric for evaluating these models actually takes inspiration from the GAN itself. We fit what we call the GBM discriminator model using a gradient boosting machine. And the job of this is we basically stack together a big data set, including both real and fake data. There's an example there on the right with age, children, wages, as well as the target being the leftmost variable there. And the job of the GBM here is just to tell, you know, is this data set real or fake? And so what that means is that, you know, a superior GAN or VAE model will be better able to fool the GBM discriminator and thus present in the form of a lower gains ratio. So keep that in mind when you look at the results, that a lower gains ratio here is actually better when you go through the results. And we also look at a few different standard checks, things like one-way and two-way distributions, as well as some goodness of fit statistics as well. So looking at the overall results, so these are from the GBM discriminator, so remember lower is better here. For the GAN, we can see we have 71% gains ratio, and that compares to 76% for the VAE, implying that the GAN is sort of slightly better, not a huge deal, so. This performance is, you know, it's reasonable. There are some systematic differences that allow the GBM to distinguish between the two. Those who are familiar with GBMs know that they have a natural variable importance metric. So when we dig into that, we find that the continuous variables dominate this. So these are things like your gross income, your weekly wages, your life satisfaction variables. And so these could be misfits in the continuous variables, given that they are a lot more complex to model. There could also be some uncaptured interaction effects. So we'll dig into that afterwards. Looking at categorical variables now. So here we just show histograms for a couple of selected variables, labor force status and self-assessed health. Both the GAN and the VAE fit pretty well. Labor force status does seem a little bit better than the fit for self-assessed health, perhaps because the variable is more stable over time, potentially better predictors of this. But overall, we think that the GAN and the VAE do a pretty good job at capturing the simple one-way effects for categorical variables. Now, the continuous ones are more challenging. So here we show the frequency polygon, or essentially a histogram, for total annual income. And we also show the quantile chart as well. So what we can see, if we look at, for example, the quantile chart here, is that there is a sort of systematic misfit here. Like the simulated data is sort of over-predicting up until like the 50th percentile and a bit under afterwards. So the fit does look decent overall, but there are some systematic misfits in the variables here. But we do think that this achieves a reasonably good fit, given the challenges dealing with mixed distributions here. And looking at interactions, so what we show here is a set of heat maps. So we show a chart of gross income against weekly wages. And on the top, we show how these two variables interact in the real data. In the bottom, we show how they interact in the simulated data. And what you want is that the simulated data essentially preserves the relationships that you observe in the real data. And what we can see here is that there are two sort of effects going on here. You can see that there is a sort of diagonal effect here representing a loose correlation between your wages and your income, which seems to be captured. And there's also an effect down the left-hand side of each chart. People who don't have any weekly wages, but have, you know, some income, potentially due to, investments or other sort of, income sources. In general, we find that these interactions are captured quite well overall. It does a reasonably good job at fitting to these interactions. And finally, looking at the, stability of these projections over time. So what we look at is the 3-year projection window. And these are done by iterating these. So remember that we take the time t data, and score to produce time t+1 and feed it back into t+2, t+3. This is where the VAE really separates itself from the GAN here. We can see that, and this is showing weekly wages as an example, but we saw a similar effect for most, continuous variables, actually. The GAN has shown a sort of substantial misfit where the entire distribution has drifted over to the right as we iterated. And that results in overestimating the wages. However, the fit to the VAE is pretty much like spot on. It's very good. And so it's, yeah, more stable. So just looking at the discussion now and, you know, what are the implications of this? So I guess the first thing I want to call out here is that it's, you know, it's remarkable that the approach, it works. It does produce pretty good quality synthetic data overall, and it does fit reasonably well to the real data, even in spite of there being, you know, many challenges like dealing with mixed distributions here. There is still a lot of work to be done here. For example, capturing dependence between individuals, which was out of scope in our work here. We do find, however, that the GBM discriminator is still relatively successful to distinguish between real and simulated data. There are some systematic differences here, and so some more advanced diagnostics, things like Shapley values, might help in diagnosing these. Overall, we find that the VAE is a superior model structure. It does have more consistent convergence. When we fitted, we went through the process of fitting like 100 of these, and we found that the GAN, a lot of these models would collapse during the fitting process, and very few of these for the VAE. It's a lot more stable when we're fitting it. The VAEs are less sensitive to the initial conditions, and as we saw at the sort of end of our results, they do have greater stability over multiple time steps, which is obviously very important for a microsimulation. And finally, looking at the discriminator-based approach for assessing the model fit, these are not used that often, but we do think that it's quite a useful tool to evaluate a model's performance overall, as it does summarize the performance through a single digit figure, essentially. And finally, looking at training time and model performance. So it does take substantial time to train. So the single time set model took about 2 hours to fit 1,000 epochs on the Hilda data. The projection speed is pretty quick. To simulate 10 million records was about 2 minutes for the GAN and about 40 seconds for the VAE, potentially due to the simpler reconstruction network. I want to call out that we did use relatively entry-level hardware, entry-level GPUs for this. And so you could get pretty substantial improvements by using stronger or even multiple GPUs, or by leveraging cloud computing, for example. And in terms of the you know, future research extensions of this model, I mean, what we've shown here is just two example AI structures, the GAN and the VAE. There are many possible that you could use, which are potentially better than these. One example might be, for example, the Wasserstein GAN, which replaces your discriminator model with a critic model, essentially, you know, provides a score for the quality of the real or the fake sample. And this model does have improved stability and fewer collapses compared to the GAN, so that's an improvement. And you could also just extend these for finer control overall. Things like including time trends and macroeconomic variables are very common in microsimulations and would probably add some improved performance here as well. So that's all that I wanted to go through. So happy to extend the floor to questions.
So if you got any questions, feel free to put your questions in the app. I'll start my question. So for this microsimulation, so for this synthetic data, say using the Hilda data sets, what's the ultimate use case? What's that used for?
Sure. Yeah, so we gave microsimulations as sort of a use case that these are sort of big resource intensive things to build. So they're sort of natural. So, I mean, the New Zealand sort of adult model probably has sort of 150 outcomes and at least that many models sort of all chained together to project forward in time. And I think to the extent that this research is successful, it sort of turns a $1 million model into a $10,000 model. Which is pretty game changing in terms of the types of models you can build and the types of applications you can use it for. with some sort of costs in terms of sort of your visibility over what's happening over under the hood is obviously sort of impacted. So that's exciting. But it's worth noting that the general motivation we had, so at least two outcomes and interdependence between them, is actually a very general purpose problem. So any situation where you're wanting to generate distributions under those circumstances, it's actually sort of quite useful. So even something like a claims reserving triangle, where you're trying to estimate the distribution of the lower half of the triangle, you've got more than one cell. And so that's exactly the type of problem you've got there. So it's quite general purpose. I guess we've just focused the example on Hilda and sort of looking at sort of time steps, because that's where we spend a lot of modeling resource and some of our projects.
Yeah, I guess just to add to that, like a lot of these micro simulation models may consist of hundreds of smaller sub-models, which obviously require a lot of time investment to build and scrutinize and, you know, assess diagnostics. It could be a huge time save to replace it with a single model.
Yep, we just got a question coming. Can this GAN, and VAE models be constructed using publicly available packages, say Python packages, or they're publicly available?
We do use all sort of publicly available packages. We did need to make some sort of modifications. As you saw, Hugh went through, you know, the GAN and the modified GAN for the purposes of microsimulations, likewise with the VAE and the modified VAE. There are some small tweaks we've made, but they are all largely based on, you know, public packages.
Yeah, so we use PyTorch primarily, so which is the most popular sort of package for building deep learning models these days, I think. And so the way I described the model setup at the beginning, where you sort of say, sort of, here's the data, here's the network, and sort of here's the loss function to say whether it's good or bad. In some ways, it's almost that easy nowadays. Like, you don't actually have to spend a lot of time specifying all the nodes. You basically say, here's a layer, here's a layer, here's a layer, off you go. Although we may have presented in a slightly slapdash way, the way you build a lot of these models nowadays is quite slapdash in that sense that you can actually just stick some pieces together and see what happens. So it's quite fun. So you should do it.
Yeah. So for the real data case, have you compared your model outputs between, say, macro simulation results versus like the GAN or VAE results?
I'm not sure what you mean in terms of comparing it to micro simulation results. We did look at comparing, for example, the speed of these models.
I mean, say the distribution, say one way, two ways, or like what you did in the simulation parts. Have you done that for the real data ones?
So the Hilda example was a real dataset example.
Oh, yeah.
And so we went through some of the distributions. We did look at all of the one-way distributions for all the different 74 variables. I think there are like several hundred in Hilda, but we've selected a handful that are of interest. And as well as the distributions of the continuous variables, and they match up reasonably well. And they also are able to preserve most interactions observed in the real data as well.
So do you think this model's performance outperform the traditional micro simulation model in terms of preserving those patterns in the real data sets?
Yeah, so comparing it to a traditional microsimulation, we haven't looked at, fitting 74 different sub-GLMs, variable. I think it'll be hard to say whether it does outperform. I suspect that the traditional one may look better because you are spending more time fine-tuning every single variable. But I think this does sort of get most of the way there in, you know, much quicker time.
Yeah, I think that's right. So it would have been nice if we could have used one of our existing data sets and microsimulation models and actually done the test. We haven't done that partly because governments, in their wisdom, don't like us mucking around with data sets for no reason. But we probably will sort of do a pilot at some stage, which would be fun. Doing it on Hilda, which is sort of a bit more public and accessible, is good, but obviously then we are too lazy to bother fitting the whole sort of laborious thing up to do the comparison. So I think I agree with Justin's prognosis in terms of performance. I also think there's a lot of untapped potential for improvement, given we're just stumbling around in the dark at the moment. So.
Yeah, so it seems there's lots of potential or lots of advantages using the GAN or VAE models compared to the traditional ones in terms of speed, in terms of performance. But is there any risk that you foresee for using this type of models?
I think the risks are probably similar to the risks in the big micro simulation, which is that how do you know once you've chained together that many different models and that many different time steps that you've got something sensible at the end? And that the current method for doing that is squinting and deciding it's okay, and sort of keeping things constant enough that the types of insights you're drawing out are still useful and sort of will hold up to scrutiny. I guess one minor contribution that comes from this work as a bit of a spin-off is there is actually a slightly more scientific way to do it, which is actually say, well, if we've got at least 10 years of data, why don't we just run it for 10 years and then shove it through that GBM discriminator and say, well, can it distinguish the difference between our 10 years of sim and the actual 10 years? And that's actually something we've not done before, actually sort of applying that sort of test. So that's sort of one extra arrow we've got for doing that. In terms of other risks, I think not especially. So I think actuaries are sort of pretty good at sort of knowing you've got your input data and you understand risks about sort of gaps in that. You've got models and we sort of are increasingly comfortable working with black boxy type models with inputs and outputs. And then you've got outputs and sort of testing sort of how they perform.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Any further questions from the audience? Yes, please.
So I think, we show just one potential way that you could deal with this. As you said, we essentially model the point mass first, and then during the, as well as the continuous part, and then during the forward pass, we essentially, check for whether, the point mass part is satisfied and sort of override the values. There are, many different ways you could deal with this, but we haven't really sort of investigated other approaches. There could be, better approaches to that.
Yeah, I think I agree with the comment. It's a great one. The more integrated you can make the model in terms of one step, the better it'll be in terms of flexibility. And certainly the first version of it, we'd done some sort of hacks around the categorical variables as well, that sort of took that sort of point mass idea where we sort of were simulating and actually replacing that with the gumball that effectively builds it into the model structure proved to be a lot less coding and sort of fiddling as well as actually sort of better performance. So there's probably opportunities there.
Okay, thank you. Please join me in thanking Hugh and Justin for this great